they come!
I don't hear nothing.
Wait for it.
Attention all personnel. Report immediately to admitting ward and operating room. Attention all personnel. Report immediately to admitting ward and operating room.
Episode of MASHcast, the show that celebrates the greatest television series of all time, CBS's MASH, which ran from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Corporal Captain Rob Kelly, and joining me for this debut episode is a longtime friend, the Fire and Water Podcast Network, and equal MASH fanatic, Russell Burbage. Hi, Russell.
Hello.
It's great to have you here, man. This is the first time we've actually podcasted together.
It is a pleasure and an honor to be here today.
Thank you very much. Like I said, when I was deciding to do the show, finally sort of pull the trigger on it, I was like, Russell has to be my first guest because you were commenting on my MASH blog, like right from the very first post on and continued on. And I always appreciated that. So, and like I said, you've been on Secret Origins and you've been on Who's Who and stuff, but you and I've just never had the chance to podcast together. So I figured this is the perfect opportunity. So I'm very excited and I'm thrilled that you were willing to do it because like I said, the podcasting with me is not always the easiest thing in the world. So
forget I podcasted with Shag. So I'm ready, man. I am absolutely ready.
It's a good point. Can't possibly be any harder than that. So
no.
First off, I want to talk about why are we here? Why are we doing this show? As everybody knows, MASH is my favorite TV series of all time. Ever since I started watching it when I was a kid, it pretty much was my favorite, and it stayed that way, and it's been that way all through adulthood. It is one of the big things of my life. Like, if I had to limit it down to, like, the things that were important to me as a young person, and then later on as an adult, like the things out there that are entertainment related, it would have to be kind of this weird triumvirate of Aquaman, which of course Russell you share, and MASH and Bob Dylan, and I do shows on two of the three of those things. So I figured why not do a show about this. I mean, there are other MASH podcasts out there, but I haven't had a chance to do it, and I did an FW Presents episode with Zaki Hassan, more on him in a bit, about the history of the show, because Zaki loves the show, and that was very well received. And every time I've mentioned that I might do a MASHcast, I've gotten a very positive response, so I figured, why not do it? And if you're listening to this episode on the day that it drops, which is February 28th of 2018, that is the 35th anniversary to the day of the airing of the final episode, which remains the highest rated like fictional television episode of all time. And it's a record that will obviously never be broken the way television is nowadays. Now, Russell, did you, I want to get into like your history with the show. I mean, I know it, but I want the listeners to know about it. But did you watch the final episode when it aired live?
Yes, I did. The group of us from high school all got together at a friend's house and we all sat and watched it.
Yeah, everyone did. It was just the biggest thing ever. What is your like history with the show? Did you watch it as a kid as well?
Well, when I was a kid, my parents, I'm the youngest of four, and I had no say in what was on the TV until my sisters went away to college. And so I remember distinctly that my parents watched CBS on Saturday nights. It was All in the Family and Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart and MASH and Carol Burnett. For at least a year or two, those shows were all together. And I don't remember thinking it was all that interesting at the first few seasons. Mm-hmm. So, because I would have been about 10 or so, I guess. So then I remember distinctly that the Scholastic Dynamite magazine that could order from Dynamite. My elementary school had a cover of Mike Farrell and Alan Alda and Harry Morgan talking about the cast changes on MASH. And I read that and I thought, this sounds interesting. And I started watching it religiously after that. But it was always on in the background, as it were. And I remember my parents were really upset with the episode with Henry Blake died at the end of the third season. So it was always there, but I didn't really start watching it until I guess that would have been 1975 or so.
That's amazing. I have that issue of Dynamite. I think you might have even sent that to me.
I think I may have sent that to you. Yeah. Saw, oh, my God, this is the book that I remember seeing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's not a show that you would think a lot of little kids would watch, because what's the appeal there? There's the, you know,
right.
it's mostly dialogue. It's set in the past, of course, during the Korean War. And so for a lot of little kids, it's like, well, what is any, you know, it's all these references that nobody understands. But
right.
I don't know. I hooked into it immediately. I've always been, I like the idea of a group of people that are bonded together and have each other's backs. That's something that's always been of interest to me. And people that are doing the best they can under extremely difficult circumstances. And I've always been an appreciator of sort of history, of American history in particular. And so I kind of liked all these references. I grew up listening to these things and having an understanding of, you know, what these little obscure things are, because I watched MASH, you know. And so, yeah, it was a show that I watched as a kid. I remember airing it. I watched the last episode. I watched after MASH, for Pete's sake. I watched Trapper John MD because it was Trapper John. I mean, you know, I was in, man. And so, it's something that has always, part of the reason I am who I am, to quote Popeye, is because of MASH. It really is. I mean, they like to say, oh, entertainment doesn't influence people. Of course it does. That's why you make it, partly. And,
right.
and MASH is definitely responsible for a lot of the Hawkeye Pierce's. Well, not necessarily my favorite character of the show, and we'll get to that later on, but Hawkeye Pierce is like one of my childhood heroes. So, I mean, and it'll always be that. So I'm super excited to finally be able to do this show. So the format is going to be, we're just going to talk about one episode per show. We're just going to do, so Russ and I are going to be talking about season one, episode one, MASH the Pilot. Before we get to that, I do want to give just a brief history of the show, of how it got created. Obviously, MASH was a novel by Richard Hooker and then turned into a mega successful movie directed by Robert Altman. Elliot Gould played Trapper John. Donald Sutherland played Hawkeye Pierce. Sally Kellerman, Hot Lips Houlihan. Robert Duvall, the great Robert Duvall, was Frank Burns. Roger Bowen was Henry Blake. And you had Duke Forrest, a character that does not appear in the TV show, played by Tom Skerritt. And 20th Century Fox got the idea that they thought this would make a pretty good TV show. So they got together with CBS. They hired Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds to write and produce, respectively. And Larry Gelbart, now, this is something where I've read multiple histories that conflict with one another. I've heard in some cases that they actually offered the role of Duke Forrest to Tom Skerritt, and he turned it down, so they cut the character. But I read in books, particularly The Complete Book of MASH by Susie Coulter, which was sort of my childhood Bible, that was Larry Gelbart's decision from the beginning, that he just felt there were too many lead characters, and he decided to cut one of the three doctors, and he cut Duke Forrest. So that was eliminated entirely, which I think ended up working out in the show's best interest. Now, of course, they couldn't hire any of the movie actors because they were too expensive, and they were movie stars. So they got Alan Alda, who was coming off of a lot of TV shows and some movies. He had starred in Paper Line, which was sort of a critical success. They got him to play Hawkeye. Wade Rogers, who had done a lot of television as well and had appeared in 1967's Cool Hand Luke, was going to play Trapper. McLean Stevenson, who was a regular on the Doris Day show, to play Henry Blake, although McLean Stevenson apparently did a test for Hawkeye, which is hard to imagine. I picture him playing Hawkeye. Loretta Swit had a lot of TV credits. She had a recurring role in Hawaii 5-0 to play Hot Lips Houlihan. Larry Linville, again, a TV guy. He had appeared in the Night Stalker TV movie with Darren McGavin to play Frank Burns. Mm-hmm. And Gary Berghoff played Radar O'Reilly, one of the few actors to appear in the movie and the TV show, recurring role. And then in a some other parts are played by Karen Phillip, played Nurse Dish. This was her first credit. The actor G. Wood, again, returning from the movie, plays General Hammond. George Morgan plays Father Mulcahy, replacing Rene Auberginois, who played a movie. And, of course, George Morgan would not go on to play the part in subsequent episodes. We'll talk about that later on. And in a small role, you can see in the background, the great Bruno Kirby plays Boone.
I did notice him.
He's credited as playing Boone, one of the sort of gang of Hawkeye and Trapper's gang. And there he is, the famous Bruno Kirby. And Bruno Kirby at this point was just sort of a jobbing actor. He was only 2 years away at this point from being in Godfather 2. So, I mean, and had a big part in Godfather 2. So he was on the upswing at this point. But there he is. You know, I think he doesn't even get a line. You just sort of see him in the background. But we have other actors that fill out the cast. But this was basically how the show was put together with these actors, and Larry Gelbart put it together. And Alan Alda was sort of the critical driver of this because he did not want MASH to be, as they put it, Abbott and Costello go to war. He wanted this show to really be sort of focusing on the real life, what it was like to serve, you know, in a war situation. And Larry Gelbart promised Alda that we're never even going to consider that. It was always supposed to be sort of a real thing. So with the stage is set for that. First episode, again, MASH the Pilot. It aired September 17th, 1972, written by Larry Gelbart, directed by Gene Reynolds. Now, this episode opens in a way that no other episode of MASH opens, is that it has a cold open. We see the doctors playing golf with a little crayon that says, Korea 1950, 100 years ago. Now, Russell, when do you remember seeing this pilot? Because when they air this episode in syndication, they cut all this stuff out and they just stick the regular credits for it. Do you remember when you first saw this?
I remember it starting that way. So I must have seen it either in before they got sliced it up for, you know, real syndication or the – God, I can't imagine it would have been first run. But, I remember seeing that part of it because I always remember – watching very closely as to what scenes they kept for the real opening and what they cut.
Right. Yeah, the syndicated episodes, which is where I saw most of these episodes, were really cut to ribbons. And later on, when the show got put on DVD, it features all these scenes I'd never seen before. And I have seen every episode I've seen every episode of MASH so many times that they're like song lyrics. And I can my ear can instantly pick out even the tiniest little detail. I'm like a dog, you know, with like a squirrel, you know, like I can hear that. I can immediately pick out the smallest difference. And I remember in the 80s, they did one of these news magazines, like a 48 Hours type thing, did a retrospective on MASH, and they interviewed Loretta Swit, and somebody, probably for an anniversary or something. And they played the clip of them throwing the football around with Radar. And Radar gets the ball, and then he stops. And they're like, what's going on? And he goes, choppers are coming. And they're like, we don't hear it. And he goes, wait for it. And then they cut to the opening credits. And I remembered seeing that going, what is that? I've never seen that before. Like, it drove me nuts that there was such a scene. And it wasn't until the DVDs that I finally saw this opening. So the show opens with a montage of all the different characters. And we see, you know, all of them doing different things. Hawkeye is doing this, and Henry is romancing a nurse. We see Trapper. There's a whole scene where we see a man and a woman come out of the men's shower together, which are obviously not supposed to be doing. And then interspersed with that footage are the scenes that we will later see in the opening credits, where we see them approach the chopper and all this stuff like that. It's interesting. You see that famous shot of Hawkeye pop into the frame. And in this extended version, we see Nurse Dish pop up right behind him. And they will use that same shot for every episode for the next 11 years. They'll just cut it right before Nurse Dish pops into the frame. So we see that same shot over and over again. So it's kind of startling to see the song that you're used to seeing, Suicide is Painless, written by Robert Altman's son. And yet here it's like an extended version. And that's going to open this episode as well. We're going to get to hear this extended version. So right there, it's like, wow, this is different than anything I'm used to seeing. And it's not really meant to sort of air that way. So the plot is basically it opens up with, again, Radar playing football. He sees we pan over his shoulder. We see the now familiar helicopters as they arrive with wounded. This episode is narrated by Hawkeye as he writes a letter to his dad. And in fact, sort of the first real line of dialogue of the show is "Dear Dad," which, of course, MASH will use over and over again later on. We get an instant sense that this is not your typical TV doctor when Hawkeye asks Major Houlihan to move out of his way. Otherwise, he'll have to cut around her B-cups. So this is not Marcus Welby or Dr. Kildare or any of the godlike healers we've seen on TV before. The plot concerns Hawkeye and Trapper's effort to hold a raffle to raise enough money to send their houseboy, Ho-John, played by Patrick Idiarte, to college back in the States. They figure the best way they can raise the cash is for the prize to be a nurse. In this case, Nurse Dish, Karen Phillip, considered to be the most desirable woman in camp. After Hawkeye and Trapper have a run-in with Frank, who smashes their still in a moment of anger and suffers the humiliating consequences, Henry cancels the party, but then takes a trip to Seoul to meet up with General Hammond. Of course, that means the party is on. After drugging Frank to get him out of the way, the party commences, and it seems like almost the entire camp is crammed into the mess tent, except for Hot Lips, who goes on a frantic search to find Frank. Colonel Blake and General Hammond make a surprise return to the 477th just in time to see Hawkeye announce the winner of the prize, Father John P. Mulcahy. Hot Lips, having discovered the drug Frank, drags him into the mess tent, pointing a finger at Hawkeye and Trapper, exclaiming, "Those two, they're ruining this war for all of us." General Hammond is about to put both doctors under arrest when wounded arrive. Hawkeye and Trapper's superb surgical skills impress Hammond, who decides not to have them arrested. He tells Henry to make sure not to lose them, even to me. Hawkeye and Trapper are disappointed and have even handcuffed themselves, hoping this would be their ticket out. Henry informs them, forget it. He was too impressed to have you arrested. So, Russell, what do you think? There's two questions to ask about this. First of all, what do you think of this as an episode? And what do you think of this as a pilot?
Well, let me answer that second question first, because as a pilot, it's fascinating. It sets up all of the different dynamics that you've got and several, you know, different paths that we could get. For example, we didn't talk about him, but Timothy Brown is in the swamp as Spearchucker Jones.
Spearchucker, right.
And it's like, oh, he's another, you know, supporting character that's going to be, you know, part of the ensemble. And then there's General Hammond, who it looks like is going to be mommy and daddy that, you know, Margaret and Frank are going to run to, and he's going to be involved in some of the, I don't know if shenanigans is the right word, but the after effects. So, okay, look, this is interesting. They're setting up the good guys and the bad guys. It reads really well. You can see where there's, you know, 8 to 10 various characters here that, you know, almost unlimited plot potentials for all of them. I could see if I was an executive in 1972 thinking, yeah, green light this, let's go with it. It sees very well, don't you think, as a pilot? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you get the dynamic, like you just said, very, very easily that it's, yeah, Hawkeye and Trapper are going to get into these scrapes and shenanigans, and they're going, and Henry's going to kind of go along with it, but he's a weak commander, certainly. And then you got Margaret and Frank who are going to constantly kind of go around Henry and over his head and try and get Hawkeye and Trapper in trouble. And if Hawkeye and Trapper being just captains versus the majors, Burns and Houlihan, right, they're going to be running into this. And yeah, the show is very much reminiscent of the movie in that you do have all of these other characters. You have like 5 or 6 other characters that are sort of part of the gang. And eventually the writers would learn they didn't need that. You basically could just do the show with Hawkeye, Trapper, and Radar to a certain extent. But for right now, we're seeing all these other characters run around. And you know, it's... You're immediately, of course, on Hawkeye and Trapper's side. They're doing a sleazy thing in that they're going to raffle off a nurse for a weekend.
Right.
But they're doing it for the right reasons. They're doing it to get Ho-John out of Korea, back to Crabapple Cove. Hawkeye mentions that Ho-John can live with his parents, which is a piece of continuity that will not stand the test of time over the course of 11 seasons.
Right.
But MASH never worried about that too much. So they're doing something sleazy, but they're doing it for the right reasons. And so you're immediately like, oh, okay, these are good guys. You know, we see that Frank is, you know, a big jerk. I love the original version of the still that we see. It's not that Erector set that would later on be in later episodes. The version that Frank smashes looks like something out of like a Mon Pa Kettle movie. It's just like a big jug with a wire on the end of it. And, you know, we see that even though he's a major, they can sort of bully over him because he's just so weak-willed and he's just kind of a rotten person. And it's interesting that how much sex is in this episode, because it's like Hawkeye and Dish are going at it all the time. We see Henry's clearly not very respectful of his marriage vows, ditto with Trapper. Right. And then you know, Hot Lips and Frank are big, getting busy all the time as well. And that was something they would sort of tone down a little. And that's part of the reason,
well,
apparently.
Of course, Margaret has also had sex with General Hammond, because there's a flashback to them. It's like, oh, Hot Lips in Fort Benning. You know, and there's that scene in them, clearly some medical office where they're
making out.
You're like, wow, she's, wow.
Yeah, so. Margaret gets around. And I think that's going to be, off the top of my head, I think that's going to be the only time MASH ever flashes back to anything. I don't think they ever do another flashback in the 11 seasons of cutting away to a previous scene. I don't think we ever see that before. But yeah, we see them in the grips of one another. There is a lot of that kind of like a carry-on nurse humor. Like those British comedies of where everybody's just kind of hopping beds back and forth. I mean, and again, that is something that they would sort of scale back as the show went on. But yeah, it sets up the situations really well. I mean, you get the idea of, okay, you could see how there would be multiple seasons worth of stories out of this, because you have to come up with a reason why are Hawkeye and Trapper able to get away with all this. Well, because they're surgeons of such high skill that even General Hammond is like, we can't afford to lose these guys, because they're going to help. They're going to fix our soldiers, and we can't afford to lose them. And so, you know, there's going to be a limit to how much trouble they can get into. I mean, they can't go too far, but there's, you know, they're always going to be sort of stuck at the 477th because they're so good at their jobs.
Right. Yeah. And so if we segue back into your first question, is how do you think it, what do I think of it as an episode? I actually don't think too much of it, because there's a lot of sex. It hinges really on one, you know, particular gag that they're going to give it to. Oh, the winner's going to be the priest. Oh, of course it is. So they're not really as naughty or dirty as you're kind of being led to believe for 20 minutes. I don't want to say chaste, but they're doing it for the right reasons. Oh, okay. And then there's not the follow through ever in any other episode about, you know, Frank's reading the Bible, for crying out loud, in that first scene where he's making out with Margaret, which shocked me. I had to go back and think, wait, that is, she's reading some medical journal and he's reading the Bible. So it's like there's all these different things that are never touched upon again. And it just was like, oh, as an episode, it was okay, I thought. But as a pilot, it had a lot more potential. That kind of damning it with faint praise, but you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Again, we have George Morgan playing Father Mulcahy. He would be replaced later on. And the only information I could find, there was a quote from Larry Gelbart. Apparently, he was asked, you know, why was George Morgan replaced? And his quote was, George Morgan is a perfectly fine actor. We wanted someone who had a quirkier personality, one that we wouldn't have to write into the script. And George Morgan was in a couple of movies before this. He was in Putney Swope, which is a Robert Downey movie, not Robert Downey Jr., Robert Downey. And he was also in the movie Greaser's Palace, which co-stars Alan Arbus. So they had a little bit of a little bit of accidental MASH crossover there. Those are both Robert Downey movies. And George Morgan had a couple of credits after this show and then basically retired. He's still around. He lives in Martha's Vineyard. He's 80 years old. He is still around. I mean, I can't help but think he must, you know, curse that day that he lost the gig, because he's like the Pete Best of MASH. I mean, he lost out on, being immortalized on television and 11 years of employment. But, we actually don't hear him speak in this episode.
That's what I was going to say. When you talked about Bruno Kirby, I was like, well, I didn't notice if he had a line or two, but I did notice that Father Mulcahy doesn't have any lines. He does that one gesticulation when there's a fly bothering him outside of his tent.
Right,
which
he
is
the cross.
Wonderful, the wonderful sight gag. And he's got a great double take when they pull his name out at the raffle, but he has no lines. Wow, that is very interesting.
Yeah, so it's weird to just see, you're like, wow, that's supposed to be William Christoffel. It's very strange. I mean, I think there are a lot of really funny lines in this one. I love Hot Lips's, those two, they're ruining this war for all of us. Is going to give you an insight to her personality, that war is something that everyone should just be enjoying. And if only wasn't for these two, this would be a great place. Yeah. And you're like, what the hell are you talking about, Margaret? And that's a great – and Loretta Swit's line read is perfect. And it's interesting that you can't help but compare and contrast these actors to the film versions, because of it. I'm sure that's what everybody was doing, because the film was such a mega success. I mean, I think it seems as though that Alan Alda understood Hawkeye from the get-go. He had it down. And, I mean, the character would evolve over time, but he really seemed to fully understand it. Larry Linville, you mentioned that he's reading a Bible, which is something that was carried over from the Robert Duvall version.
Right.
Later on, they would really dial that back to where Frank was more of a military guy than he was like a religious guy, exactly. And although the moments where he talks about his religiosity, we realize it's all phony, yeah. It's all fake anyway.
Right.
Wayne Rogers... It's funny because in the movie, Trapper John is really the kind of the main character. And here, already, from the very first episode, Trapper is kind of the less of two equals. Because the story hinges on Hawkeye. It's Hawkeye's parents that are going to take Ho-John in. It's his college. It really is like a Hawkeye story.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I wanted to talk about that. Because as a pilot, you would think that if the idea was to be this ensemble cast and the two leads with the supporting lead of Henry Blake being kind of the in-between them and the co-stars of Larry Linville and Loretta Swit, then Wayne Rogers should have had a little bit more to do. And yet all of the really funny good lines were went to Alda. And it's, you're watching it. I'm not surprised that Wayne Rogers was unhappy with the role or the size that he was being given. And it never got really any better. There were a couple Trapper John episodes, but in general, it was the Alan Alda show right from the beginning, which I had forgotten.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there were a couple episodes where there really was an ensemble. And then they really tried to do, I think, but, you know, maybe we can talk about this later if you want, but I think because of the Henry Blake and Trapper John leaving, the producers, I think, went a little bit better in the direction of let's give more for Klinger to do. Let's give more for you know, BJ to do to keep them in the spotlight. I mean, clearly it was an Alan Alda-centered world, but they had a lot more to do than Henry Blake or Trapper John ever was really given.
Yeah,
in general.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think we realized that in later seasons, and we'll get onto this as the show goes on, but yeah, I think once they brought in Potter and BJ, they realized that, you know, we could give more episodes or more specific stuff about the other characters, and Hawkeye didn't need to be so central, although, of course, he was always central because he's the main character. Yeah. He's literally the only character to appear in all 251 episodes.
Yeah.
But there was something about, you know, Alda just had it down. And I think if you're a writer and you're looking to someone who can deliver jokes and get the most laughs out of your material, you're going to give it to the guy who seems to have the character on lockdown. And that was Alan Alda. And I love the bit. I mean, we'll talk about this in all later episodes as well. But like again, I like the old time references, and I love the Hawkeye's line is when we see Frank get dragged into the mess tent with all the bandages, and he's like, and Hawkeye does, the mommy strikes, doing a great Peter Lorre impression. And
Peter
it's like,
Lorre,
if they don't explain what that is, and it's like you have to just kind of know what that is, and I didn't at the time. Later, as I got older and I saw Peter Lorre movies, I was like, oh, he's doing Peter Lorre. It's like, it's great. Like, I loved all that stuff. It was like reference humor before reference humor was a thing. I love all that. So, Hawkeye, Alan Alda just really had it from the very beginning. And, and it's interesting, again, like how much Nurse Dish is in the show. Like, she is a significant character, and they establish that Margaret is head of the nurses. She's a major, but yet Nurse Dish seems to kind of not really be worried about Margaret. There's a point where Hawkeye mouths off to Margaret in the mess tent, and Nurse Dish just sort of goes along with it. I'm like, isn't Nurse Dish worried about getting yelled at by her boss? It's very strange.
Yeah, that is strange.
What did you think about Karen Phillip? I mean, I think she's fine, but it's I could see why as for the writers, it's like you don't want to pair off Hawkeye that quickly. You want to give him lots of opportunities for other storylines. And so if you give him a regular girlfriend, it kind of ruins that.
Yeah, and it reminds me a little bit of the whole Star Trek, Yeoman Rand type thing. Mm. It's like, oh, you got this woman next to the captain that's going to be love interest, but wait, if we do that, we're going to, close off all of these other interests that we might potentially have, so we better not do that. And there was a line in the episode where she's like, I'm engaged, I'm saving myself or something. So it's a little bit like, are they really having sex or is she just having sex with Hawkeye? She doesn't want to sleep with everybody. Or is it that he's just trying to, get her and she's resisting? And then, of course, like you say, the producers probably said, well, yeah, but he's a womanizer, so he's going to hit on that comes to town, and then she was quietly kind of retired.
Yeah, I mean, there's that whole montage of him trying to get with her. We see her, like, in the laundry right. bag at one point. This is the only time we see, I think the only episode where we see the camp library, where we see that there's an actual yeah. camp library. They never refer – they refer to it in later episodes, but we never see it again. And, again, this is the over time, the show would contract where they would have less yeah. – I mean, in later episodes, we would see that MASH has a dentist. That's a character they would eventually get rid of. And there's a right. again, there's the library. There's lots of stuff here very reminiscent of the movie that eventually the TV show would just sort of trim down and say, well, we don't have all these things. So I liked seeing all that stuff. I like all these little glimpses into, like, this sort of, like, alternative MASH universe.
Let me ask you, when did you see the movie? Because as a kid, the movie existed, but I never saw it. I was too young to get into an R-rated picture, and it was, you know, by the time I was old enough, it wasn't showing, and this was almost pre-VHS type stuff. So I didn't see it until after the series was over. I saw it in like 84, 85. So I was actually comparing them to the later characters or the even later characterizations. So when Frank is shown us to be like basically a total twit in seasons 4 and 5, he's just annoying, or I mean, he's incompetent, but he's, you know, he's keeping up. You know, some of the later episodes where they're having deluge or things like their 12 hours of meatball surgery, he's keeping up. He's just not as good as the other two guys. So it was always kind of like, oh, they've now written him into a corner of being just a total idiot and incompetent, and he's more interested in getting the BBs into the, you know, the little toy that he puts in. It's not forgetting things in somebody's patient's body. You know what I mean?
Right,
so
right.
I would – it's kind of like chasing – the dog chasing its tail. It's, you look at the early MASH episodes and you compare them to later Alan Alda or later Colonel Blake or Colonel Potter, and you see, wow, that's not a direction that they decided to go in or something, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm like you. I saw the movie long after I saw the show wrapped up, because like you, I would have been too young. I was 12 when the MASH show went off the air, so I would not have been allowed to see the MASH movie. I mean, it's got nudity and all kinds of stuff in it. I rented it on VHS. I mean, not too long after that is when video rental really became right. like a thing. And I knew that there was a MASH movie. I was aware of it, but I had never seen it. And then I was like, oh, wow, MASH the movie. Let's finally see this. And then, yeah, it really was like looking at the golden age version, you know, Earth 1, Earth 2
right. yeah.
of MASH. Because right. you're like, well, yeah. these are characters I'm all familiar with, but they're all played by different people and they're doing things. And this was something we got into briefly on the Film and Water podcast that I did with Zaki Hassan and Brian Hall, talking about MASH the movie, where the 477th, as shown on the TV show, is a place that if I had to go to war, I would have wanted to have been at, because it seems like a bunch of really great people. And yeah. I mean, ultimately, the show doesn't want you to go to war. I mean, in fact, Hawkeye has a line about wanting to, you know, in the classic episode, The Interview, about, you know, wanting to go to war, wanting to be there while it's happening. That's just completely antithetical to him. And so, yeah, I would never want to serve in a war. I'm a big chicken. But if you have to, being at the 477 seems like the place to be, because people are nice and they're good at their jobs and it's run well, at least under Potter. It's run well and stuff like that. But the 477th as depicted in the movie is a place I would never want to go to, because it looks vicious and mean and kind yeah. of – they seem kind of cruel. Yeah. They seem like a really hostile in crowd. And it's like, if you're not part of the cool crowd, you're really going to get torn apart, even if you're not a bad yeah. guy like Frank Burns. And so – I appreciate the movie for what it is. I think it's a masterpiece. It's a comedic masterpiece, and Altman deserves all the credit that he got for it. But it's not the version of MASH I would want to have spent a lot of time at.
Right. I totally agree. And that I would yeah, I agree.
All right, fair enough. Yeah, it's I can imagine. It's kind of funny. I mean, you look back at it now and you say, well, MASH is more famous for being a TV show than it is for a movie. But you watch right. the movie and you go, how are we going to make a show about this? It's all full of blood and sex and people. I mean, good Lord, there's a whole plot line in the movie about them spying on the dentist simply because he has a large penis and all the guys like to just look at that. I mean, you're like, this thing is filthy. How are we going to yeah. make this on a TV show? But they found a way to kind of sand the edges down in a way to make it palatable. And there, again, for this show does have a lot of sex talk in it. And my favorite joke, which we'll get to in a moment, is actually about sex, which is funny. But yeah, I think this is a good, it's a good pilot. I mean, we haven't really talked much about Henry and Radar. They established their relationship immediately, that Radar is sort of really the brains behind the outfit, and that Henry doesn't want to be a commander. He's thrown into the role. It's kind of interesting that when you think about that, this first episode is not an origin episode. You know, like, they're all already there. We don't right. we don't see them show up. In later episodes, they'll make reference to, "Hey, Frank, you've been crazy since the day you showed up." So, I mean, there was a day where everybody reported for duty on the first time, but we don't see that here. Everybody's already kind of got their jobs in place, but we see from the beginning that Henry doesn't really want to be a boss. He's there because he has to, because he's older. He's a lieutenant colonel, but he's really a doctor, and he really relies on Radar to run the outfit. And we see that, and that's apparently an invention of Gary Berghoff. So, I mean, Clayne Stevenson gives Berghoff credit for saying it was the double talk, all that stuff. That was all Gary Berghoff's invention. And, you know, mad props to Gary Berghoff, because that was one of the funniest things about the whole show. And their relationship between Radar and Henry is beautiful. It's such a total father and son kind of thing.
Yeah. And they didn't have a whole lot to do in this particular episode, but the whole idea of having Henry sign off on the weekend pass while he's supposedly ordering ice cream.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like he's just signing paperwork, and it's like who hasn't had a boss or a manager who doesn't have any isn't paying attention to what they're signing? That's just classic.
Yeah.
So
Gary
Berghoff as Radar is one of those other characters that he was actually in the movie, and then if you go back in some of the first season episodes, you watch him, and he's more conniving. You know, he's to me that he's not this. Well, maybe it's more surprising that he turned into this little wide-eyed innocent who'll just drink grape knee-high later, kind of a caricature, when in earlier he knows exactly what's going on. You know, he wants to spy on the nurses and all these other things. And it's like he kind of took his characterization took another change as well.
Yeah, I guess it works well as a nice contrast to Hawkeye and Trapper, that he is more innocent and wide-eyed. But yeah, you're right. In the beginning and in the movie, he's much more a wheeler-dealer and a behind-the-scenes kind of guy. I mean, he's in on all the dirty pranks and stuff that they do when they pull the tent up on Margaret as she's showering. Radar's part of that. I mean, that's not anything that Gary Berghoff would have done as Radar in the TV series. And I will say, you know, I mentioned at the top of the show that, you know, MASH is really in a lot of ways responsible for the person I am. I mean, I can't pinpoint specifically, like, you know, why I did certain things the way I did. But, I mean, Radar's love of animals, Radar's kindness, which is not on display here, but it will be very soon. That was a big thing for me. That was a big, big part of the things that became important to me in life, was his love of animals and his kindness and stuff like that. And again, I have to give all credit to Gary Berghoff for giving those shadings. And it did work better. He's a nice contrast to the other characters, you know. But he's always respectful. I love that he's always sort of nice to Major Burns, even though Burns is always a dick to him. He's just like a nice guy. He's a nice kid. And so Gary Berghoff did a great job. And said everybody here is set up really well. The show shows with the second episode, we'll see that they do not worry about in-episode continuity, because at the end of the show, Ho-John, they raise enough money for Ho-John to go to college, but yet Ho-John's around in subsequent episodes, so he clearly didn't go to Crabapple Cove to live with Hawkeye's dad and not-dead mother. They kind of just didn't worry about that stuff.
Looking over the whole first season or the whole life of the series, it's funny to see that it opens with Korea in 1950, and yet the Korean War ended in, you know, July of 1953. So we're swooshing, you know, 11 years of episodes into less than 3 years of actual time. It's amazing.
There will have to be – I mean, there's that famous episode where a whole year of MASH takes place, which makes your head hurt. If you try and think about it, it is like, if you think Crisis on Infinite Earths was confusing, try watching that episode because we will get into it as the show goes on, but you have to think about that all of the events of the MASH TV series take place in just 3 years. So you're like, well, how long was Trapper even at the 477th? Like a month?
Right.
I mean, like, how did this work out? But they just have to paper over those things. You really can't worry too much about it. Not to get too far ahead, but just to get into the history of the show a little bit more. When this episode aired, the pilot, It landed with a thud, basically. It was one of the lowest rated shows on the air. Critics were pretty much unimpressed. They said, this is, God, it's not funny. It's really, it's, you know, this isn't going to last. Proving that, of course, nobody knows anything. And it would be later on, MASH would limp along in its first season as a near the bottom of the Nielsen ratings basement. And it was only apparently thanks to the efforts of William Paley's wife. William Paley ran CBS, but William Paley's wife loved MASH. And apparently every week when it would air, she would berate her husband for treating the show so shabbily. And she would be like, you know, this show is great and you should treat it better and whatever. And that, according to Larry Gilbert, that pillow talk really helped because in season two, they moved MASH from its time slot to Saturday nights. They moved it right behind All in the Family.
Right.
And it became part of that block that you mentioned earlier where it was All in the Family, yeah. MASH, Mary Tyler Moore, the Bob Newhart show. I mean, some of the best shows ever to be on television, all in one night.
Right.
And audiences discovered it at that point, and it became a monster hit, and it stayed a monster hit for the remaining 10 seasons. Larry Gilbert even sort of addresses the new audience in season two, but again, that's for a later episode. But this initial episode was not regarded that well. People just kind of went, all right, I don't know if this is going to last, but luckily cooler heads prevailed and the show got to live on. I want to ask you, as I ended every blog post over on aftermash.blogspot.com, Russell, what is your favorite joke from this episode?
Well, my favorite scene is the one you already picked up on, the one when Frank walks into the mess tent being guided by Margaret, and he's still got all of the bandages on his face, and he looks like the mummy, and Anna says, "The mummy strikes." And I had seen enough of the Abbott and Costello horror movies and the Universal horror movies that on Saturday afternoons to know what that was, and thought it was hilarious. And that every time that comes on and I see that, I break out laughing again because I think that is just totally funny.
Hawkeye's a big movie fan, as we'll learn over the years. He's like, he has internalized a lot of movies. In fact, there's a later episode where he makes a movie joke, and Margaret even says, "Why are you like this?" Yeah, he's just like, because he loves the movies. He's a big guy. Yeah, that is a funny gig. My favorite
That's
line.
That's absolutely Larry Gilbert line, too, because Larry Gilbert loved the movies.
Yes. Yeah. My favorite line is when Hawkeye and Trapper are trying to determine what they can raffle off to raise the most money for Ho-John, and Hawkeye says, you know, and he says, "What do they want?" Well, to go home, or at the very least, a trip to Tokyo. And Hawkeye goes, "What do they really want?" And Trapper goes, "Sex." And then he pauses and he goes, "Except for those baseball perverts," which is, I just love that line of referring to people that are not into sex as perverts. I think it's just an inversion of everything we would come to expect. And I love the sort of lascivious way that Wayne Rogers puts a spin on the line. So, it's a good episode. It's severely edited in the syndication version because, like I said, they lop off that whole front part. You do see George Morgan in the opening credits for every episode of MASH, and that scene of them huddling down on the helicopter pad, and you see Hawkeye's clearly talking to them all, and then they go into action. You see George Morgan in the background, so he is in every episode of MASH, if accidentally.
Yeah, and so is Odessa Cleveland as Ginger, isn't she? Front and center in the running nurses scene that she's there. So.
Yeah. I mean, we see all these people who, you know, didn't get to stay on the show, or some of them did, but they all are immortalized in that opening credits.
Yeah.
And we eventually, in the second episode, we'll see the shortened version of the song. But yeah, it's the syndicated version cuts all this stuff out. And I was so glad that I got the DVDs and I finally got to see it because it really is just remarkable to hear the voiceover and explaining it all and hear this extended version. It's really great. So that is MASH the pilot. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we sign off on this episode, Russell?
Well, I have two things I was going to talk about just briefly.
Go right ahead.
MASH has a habit of using Japanese songs in their backgrounds. And in this episode, they have My Blue Heaven in Japanese and they have Happy Days Are Here Again in Japanese. And I always wondered why, because they're in Korea. It's not Japan. And why they didn't – maybe they were easier to get the credits for than like a 1950 – I almost said Petula Clark. That's not who I meant. I Can See Her Face. Doris Day or people
Doris
like
Day,
that.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, why are they using that musical background? And it always pulls me out of the story as soon as I hear those tunes because I'm thinking, why? do you have any reason? Would you – Did you even notice?
I certainly didn't. I mean, no, I never really noticed. You're an expert at that culture, and so I don't really know. I always figured it was just to get in a song that helps put you in the time and place. You know, they're like, oh, this is a song from 1950. This is a song from 1950. Oh, we know where we are at this point. I was, it was just sort of scene setting.
Yeah, well, and I guess in that sense, it's one of the criticisms we can throw at MASH, because they mix all of those eras together without really paying much attention to what actually it is from a certain time. So it's like, you know, Happy Days Are Here Again is from the 30s, but I don't know when the Japanese version would have been made, but still, it's just kind of an odd thing. And speaking of odd things, the other thing I wanted to talk about was Ho-Jeon, because he's played by a clearly non-Korean actor. Mm-hmm. And every time I see him, I think, okay, we're supposed to believe that he's a Korean. He's clearly not. So I'm glad that we're more inclusive now, that we don't necessarily cast a Filipino guy as a Korean boy.
Yeah, Patrick Ediarte was Filipino. He was in Flower Drum Song and The King and I as well.
Yeah, so I saw him on Hawaii 5-0 all the time too.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so he had some real credit. This was one of the last things he ever did. He was in a couple of TV shows. He was in an episode of Kojak and something called The New Temperatures Rising Show, which I just love that as a title for a TV show. And then that was it. He's still around. He was born in 1942 and he's still around, but he has not been in anything since the 70s. So I wonder what happened to him. I'll have to use the vast MASH cast resources to try and find him. I would love to interview him and find out what that was like.
That would be interesting to know.
Yeah. I think that is going to do it for this first episode of MASHcast. There are just two other things I want to mention before we sign off. One is that if you are a fan of MASH, and I assume you are because you're listening to this, I would suggest you go over to the Nostalgia Theater podcast hosted by our pal Zaki Hassan, who will be on this show eventually. He is interviewing, for the anniversary of MASH's final episode, somebody you may have heard of, Mike Farrell. He's got Mike Farrell on his show. I am so excited for him. But he told me a while back that Mike Farrell agreed to do a show, and I think that's just so thrilling. So make sure to go over to the Nostalgia Theater and listen to that episode, because in the Nostalgia Theater, you should be listening to it anyway. It's a great show. I have been on it, talking about MASH, oddly enough. But it's a really great show. Zaki's a great podcaster, so go over there and check that episode out. And then the last thing I want to mention, and this is something I am going to do at the end of every episode. Right now, as we know, at least as we're recording this, there is a deal for Fox to be owned by Disney. All of Fox's entertainment properties be owned by Disney. Apparently, they haven't quite put all the dotted the I's and crossed the T's on the deal yet, but it seems like it's going to be happening, which means Disney will own MASH. Because of MASH is a 20th Century Fox property, and Disney will own it, so Disney will own MASH. Now, MASH is not available for streaming for some reason. It was on Netflix for like a hot second, and Darlin Tracy and I watched like every episode, and then they got rid of it, and it has not been back since. It's not on Hulu, even though Hulu has like Bewitched and like Night Gallery and Hawaii 5-0 and all these old shows. MASH is not available, and it's also not available on iTunes. It's just not available anywhere. It plays in reruns. It's on MeTV, I know, all the time and stuff. But it is not available for streaming, and I don't know why. Because that's the coin of the realm nowadays is streaming. So I'm going to end every episode begging Fox Home Entertainment or Disney, whoever owns it, please put MASH on streaming. Please get MASH available on iTunes or Hulu or Netflix, something. Get MASH out there. You're the only way you're going to build the fan base again for younger people is to get it available, to have it in front of people. So please, somebody, Disney, Fox, get this show on streaming. I beg of you. Again, I think that is going to do it for this first episode of MASHcast. I hope you all enjoy listening to it. Russell, thank you so much for doing this, man. I would not have done it without you. And thank you for being a good friend all these years. You and I have met over the Aquaman Shrine, and we've carried on through all these different things, and it's just amazing all the things you and I have in common. Like, you would follow, you comment on my MASH blog. My God, it's like Russell and I were like brothers from another mother kind of thing. And so I really appreciate you doing this, and it's great to finally have a chance to podcast with you.
My pleasure. It was wonderful to have finally gotten together with you on a podcast.
Cool. Where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I spend most of my time in the 31st century. I'm on Legion of Super Bloggers, .blogspot.com, and then I have my own thing that's seginonakamura.blogspot.com. But if you do Friends of Justice, you should be able to find me. I'm doing monthly reviews of Man Bat.
Wow.
1970s coolest character ever. So, yes, those are where you can usually find me.
Very cool. And, of course, you can find, well, not back episodes of our show, because there are no back episodes at this point, but there will be, over on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And the show has a Twitter feed, because, of course, it does. You can find us over at MASH4077cast over on Twitter. So please follow that to help us build the following over on Twitter. We can have conversations about MASH and stuff. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks for all the positive feedback I've gotten. I've been hinting about doing the show for like a year now, and people are like, when are you going to do MASHcast? And I really appreciate that. I didn't think anyone would be particularly interested in this because, as I mentioned, it's not on streaming anymore. It's not a show that's available. I didn't think there was a reserve of people that want to hear about it, but I'm super excited to do it. This show will, for right now, just be once a month. It's going to air on Wednesdays in the Film and Water time slot, as it were. But maybe as we go on and if I get a good response and I'm having fun, maybe we'll sort of increase the frequency of this, because I would love to be able to get to more episodes a lot quicker, because at the rate I'm going, it's going to take us 2 years just to get through season one. So we'll maybe try and work something out. But anyway, thanks, everybody, for the positive words. I really, really appreciate it. And leave comments over on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And please leave a review on iTunes. There are other MASH podcasts out there, and they're great, but I would love for my show to get some attention. So please go over to iTunes and leave reviews. So I don't have a sign-off worked out just yet. I got to work on that. So I'm just going to say thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you later. And I guess until then, stand down.
Which one here's McIntyre?
Yup.
You and Pierce are both under arrest.
I'd like to get a second opinion on that.
What's the charge, General?
Breaking orders by having this party.
And handing out unauthorized passes.
The mummy strikes!
Major Burns, sir.
Hamilton.
Hot lips.
Hot lips.
Those two, they're ruining this war for all of us.